morning. Last time we talked about the spread spectrum multiplexing techniques, and the idea behind spread spectrum is modulation techniques. The idea behind spread spectrum is that if you have a narrowband signal, then it's susceptible to all these channel effects as well as sort of deliberate jamming. And if you spread out the signal over a wider band, then you get some resistance to these sorts of effects. Okay. And so it's desirable from sort of an individual signal's point of view to be spread over as wide band as possible, and we saw several techniques for doing that. We then noted that, well, take up more bandwidth, it would be nice to have some way of sharing that amongst multiple users. And so we looked at how you have codes for where the codes were involved in spreading the signal, but they did it in such a way that you could decode multiple signals over the same bandwidth. We then moved on to look at cellular systems, and the goal of cellular systems, they arose from the telephony world, and the goal was to provide large-scale connectivity or coverage while a user is moving. Okay, and we saw that there's a couple of issues involved in that. The idea of how do you provide this coverage, and then naturally as users move, and then the idea of how to provide coverage is just that you provide multiple access points, each of which will have some range, and as users move, they have to change their connection from one access point to the next access. In this way, they can maintain connectivity with a network. And just keep in mind that this is sort of the first step of connectivity, and then going back into either the phone network or the internet or whatever. Okay, but you can keep that first set and keep that. So we then decided we'd have a look at fairly abstractly at how we provide this coverage and what sort of characteristics, what sort of considerations there are going to be. And so we assume that our channels are, first and foremost, for the most part, we're going to assume that all our channels are orthogonal, so they're not interfering or shared with each other. And we say, well, in that case, we can eke out a certain number of these channels out of the spectrum we're allocated. And we really don't want any channel in use being used too close to each other. You get the same thing in wireless systems as well. If you have two access points side by side, they have to operate on different frequencies. Okay, so same thing here. If you have two access points side by side, they better not be operating at the same frequency. Yeah, so the question then becomes, well, how far away from each other do they have to be? And that's what we'll look at today. The basic idea, though, is that we're going to have our set of channels, and we're going to group our cells into clusters. So we're going to take groups of cells, and we're going to share out all of our channels amongst this cluster. Okay, so that will ship an equal number of channels. So in this example, each cell in the cluster gets a third of the available channels. We then repeat the cluster over and over again to get the coverage. And so, by the way we construct the cluster, our base stations using the same channels will not be immediately adjacent to each other. And what we'll see is, you know, again, there's ways of working out how far distant they are from each other. So our question becomes, how do we decide what size our cell cluster should be? And from that lens, how many cells there are in a cluster, not contents, for how far away the reuse is happening. Now, given a desired reuse distance, we'll see roughly, that will determine how far away any two cells have to be from each other, any two cells using the same channels. And that becomes how many cells you need to cover the intervening area. That depends how many cells should be in the cluster, becomes really just the geometric exercise. And so that'll be our starting point, is the geometric exercise. Then we'll say, how do we decide on what a good reuse distance is? Well, that's related to our signal interference ratio, so how much or little interference we can tolerate from adjacent cells. The more interference you can tolerate, obviously, the closer in the reuse can happen. Okay. So our reuse distance is the minimum distance between centers of cells using the same channel set. Okay. And again, any fixed layouts of cells, the bigger the reuse distance, the less interference you're going to have. Okay. Now, what's actually of interest to us, we'll see, is the reuse distance relative to the cell radius. The cell radius gives you essentially the power that you're transmitting, or the range. And so the farther away relative to your transmission power, the better off you are. Obviously, if this cell just decided to blast out at extremely high power, it would still cause interference. But again, what we're going to assume is that everybody's going to transmit at the same power level. So, given that the cells are certain, using the reuse of channels are certain distance away from each other, that's going to contribute to the signal to interference ratio. Okay. And so the higher you want this to be, the farther away you want the interference cells. So again, it turns out that what's useful is to relate the distance to the radius of the cell, or the size of the cell. So we'll start with looking at diamonds because they're easier. And we'll see how they work. And the first thing we observe is that we can phrase our reuse distance in terms of multiples of cell radii. So you have always one radius between the centers, just the distance it takes to get to the edge is a half a radius, and the distance it takes to get from the edge to the second cell is half a radius. That gives you one radius. Sorry, it's half a diameter, so it's one radius to get to the edge, and one radius to get to the edge from the edge to the center, so two radii there. And then for each intervening cell, so for each cell between our two cells that we're looking at, again, the distance you travel is the number of cells, and it gives you 2r to get from one end of the cell to the other. So your reuse distance then is, again, in terms of r and the number of intervening cells. Okay. Now, we can do something similar for hexagonal cells, but it takes a bit of mathematical manipulation. So, if you took the xy coordinates and you tried to find the distance between any one cell and another, you're not going cleanly through each cell like you were before. On the other hand, if you change the coordinates, so you define our u direction, so that's like the y before, but now we define a v direction that goes through the centers of the cells, then if you travel either in the u or the v direction, you are going traversing the whole diameter of the cell. And so what we can say is that we can say something about the distance in terms of a path that goes in either the u or the v direction. Then we translate that back to our straight distance. Just to look at the coordinate scheme, you either go up or over, so either in the u or v direction, and you count the number of cells you traverse along the path from center to center, in either the u or the v direction. So if we wanted to get to G from A, well, our path is just from the center of A to the center of G. So you've gone 0 in the U direction and 1 in the V direction. If you want to go to S, then the path has to go through B. Again, you're going from center to center, so it has to go through B. So you've gone 1 in the U direction, 1 in the S direction. If you want to get to P, there's a number of different paths you can take. You can go down in the U direction, so -2, and then over 2 in the V direction. And M, again, you go down 1 in the U direction, and the opposite minus one in the direction. So you always want to take a path through the centers. Okay, now the benefit of these paths is you can figure out what these distances are. Because I just either in the B direction, and the B direction is just, again, in terms of counting up cell radii. Okay. And so the distance we go in the U direction is U1 minus U2, and then V is the perpendicular drop to the side of the hexagon, then you go 2D. And similarly, in the V direction is U1 minus U2 minus 2D. Now, radii for the hexagons is actually measured to the corner. And so, but you know, again, just from geometry, we can calculate what D is, and we can calculate the square root of the derivatives R. So, again, what we really want to do is calculate our direct distance. But what we have is these two legs. And so obviously what we're going to need to do is to try and determine the calculate D from knowing these two legs. Okay. Now, I'll just mention there was a typo on the slides. The V-axis was pointing down here. That should be obviously where the V-axis is. I'll post the revised copy later. Okay. So we can calculate what we essentially do is we build up a right triangle. And once we have our right triangle, obviously we can get the distance D. It's just the square root of the factors. Now, one side of the right triangle is pretty easy in the V direction. But you're just dropping that on the axis, and this is a 30-degree angle. So it's V2 minus V1. Times 2D cosine 30 degrees. In the U direction, well, we actually have to add a bit on, but again, the amount we're adding on is just V2 minus V1 squared root of 3R. It's this quantity times the sine onto the y-axis now, so kind of sine 30 degrees. So we can plug those two values in, and then we simplify this sort of notation by letting I be the difference between u coordinates and j be the difference between v coordinates. And if you do that, again, just plug in the J and the I, square the quantity you're given, then you end up with a couple of J squared terms. J squared, cosine squared, plus sine squared. You have your 2ij sine pi over 6 term, and then you have an I squared term. So cosine squared plus sine squared is 1, and 2ij sine pi over 6 plus 2ij, so sine
30 is 1 half.
So you get d squared in terms of some multiple of r squared.
You can get
B. Okay. So again, the interesting thing to note is that D is, well, D is a function of R.
Okay. So what's actually important, or what's actually of interest, is the ratio between D and R. And again, this makes sense because the R is related to the power output. So the smaller r is relative to d, and the less interference you'll have. Okay. So,
again, just geometrically, if we know, if we want some ratio of d to r, then you're going to have a certain number of intervening cells to get that ratio. And that is going to determine how many cells you need per cluster. So, we just let n be the size of our cell clusters, and again, within the n cells, we share out our channels, and then the channels are reused from cluster to cluster, not within us. N is referred to as the reuse factor.
Okay, so just to look at
that graphically, if you have other hexagonal cells, if you have 7 in the cluster, then again, you lay out these clusters of 7. Within the clusters, you share out all the channels, so there's 7 separate sets of channels to be used, and then that leads to a certain reuse distance, and again, that reuse distance is relative to the R, so relative to the cell radius. Again, you can do this with a certain number of clusters, and in order to get the tessellation, there's some restrictions on the numbers you can use.
So you have to essentially respect that I squared plus ij plus j squared factor. Okay.
And so again, here's cluster 3, so we should have had the channels between 3 cells,
etc. Okay.
So, again, what we're going to see is that our reuse factor, the number of cells we have to have in a cluster, is a function of D over R.
So it's a function of the ratio between the reuse distance and the cell radius.
Now, if you have, again, we'll start with diamond-shaped cells, just because visually easier. So here, for instance, we have a cluster, and any cluster is just going to be a square of k cells in any direction. Okay, so I'm just k squared. Okay, so that k is giving you the number
painting styles between reuse and so in particular the reuse is 2K off. So after there's K and the painting styles. So what we can do then is solve for K in terms of D and R. And we get that the number of cells in the cluster is 1/4 the over R squared. So again, the point in how we do that is again, geometric, just you know, however you set things up, that's how it will work. But it's a function of D over R. Okay. Yeah, it's similar for hexagonal cells. The way we look at it is we look at the areas of cells and essentially how many cells we need to fill in a certain area for our cluster. So the area of a cell is 3√3r²d. That just comes from the geometry of the cell. And now the cluster is also going to be hexagonal in shape, so with the diameter of our reuse distance now. And so the area of the cluster is in √3. The diameter side is √3d. And so we get √3d² over 2. Area. So the number of cells we need to fill that cluster is just the area of the cluster divided by the area of any given cell. And so that's, again, it's in terms of D over R. But now D over R is also a function of our previous coordinates, so how many intermediate cells do you live at the orbit dimension? So again, that gives us our number of cells in terms of I and J, so how we have to traverse in the B direction. And again, this means that you won't get just any value for N. But you have to get the bonds of I or J to give you that value. Okay. So, given that I and J, you can see how the reuse is made. Again, this is a big point, just as it helps you think about the I and the J. So you assign your channel sets to a certain cell, and then again, the distance that you're moving is you move I cells in. Any sort of U direction, and then J cells in the B direction. You'll reassign the same channel set. Okay. And so the body of the bicep is at either U or B direction, and then J cells in the opposite direction. Okay, so anyway, what you'll do from by doing that is for any channel, you'll assign the, you'll be able to assign the six neighboring cells with the same channel set. Okay, so again, it's might help you thinking about the coordinates. Maybe not. So far what we have is, if we're given our ratio of D to R, we know how we're going to lay out our cells. So we know how many are going to be in a cluster, and then we just lay out the clusters adjacent to each other. Now, again, the ratio of D over R is going to give you how much interference there's going to be between cells using the same channels. Okay. And so the bigger D is relative to R, the less interference you're going to get. Relatively, we're part of the price you pay for that is, again, have more intervening cells, so bigger clusters. So, again, if we look at our diamonds, these lay out. These first two have the same ratio of D over R. Okay. What we've done here is essentially covered a smaller physical area, but the proportions are the same. This means that the interference between the two cells, between the two systems, the amount of interference these two will experience is the same. So then the amount of interference is proportional to the three systems over the radius. In our second example here, we have increased our reuse distance relative to the radius, so we doubled it. And the price we paid for that is that we now have more cells per cluster. We have 4 times the number of cells per cluster. But since any given two cells have a greater intervening distance, you've also doubled the intervening distance between the cells, you're going to experience less interference from cells using the same channel set. Okay, so again, this is, it's all very geometrical, but it looks fairly strange the first time you look at it, so yeah, think about it. Okay. So we've danced around interference, and now we'll sort of address it. In general, your interference is given by whatever your signal is, and then the contributions to interference from all of the cells using the same channel set. Now, typically what we do is, or if you think about the cells using the same channel, channel sets. So we have cell here, and then it's going to be interfered with by every other cell using the same channel. But power is dropping with some exponent of distance. So what we say is that the adjacent clusters contribute to the interference. Any cluster farther away from that, the contribution is going to be very minor. So we only consider the interference from adjacent clusters. And if we assume that everything's roughly hexagonal, then there's going to be six adjacent clusters for the system. Now, what does the power look like? Well, the minimum power of the signal is if you're at the edge of your cell, and so in that case it's dropped by R times gamma, where gamma is whatever factor of power it's dropping by. For the intervening cells, they're d, our Reeves distance away, and so the power for each intervening cell is dropped by d to the minus gamma.
Okay, so again, if we consider first tier
only, then our signal to interference ratio is given by the power of the signal, which is dropped by R times gamma. And now there are k adjacent cells for hexagon space, so it would be 6, and the power for those is dropped by e to the minus. Messing around with that a bit, you've got the 1 over k, and then you have d over r to the gamma. And so again, the bigger d is relative to the r, the higher your signal to interference ratio is. Write that in terms of q as well if you want. Okay, again, all of this is geometrical. D over R is also a function of our Reeves factor, or vice versa, our Reeves factor is a function of D over R. We can substitute that value in, and we get a relationship between the signal to interference ratio and our Reeves factor, the number of cells we have in the cluster. And again, what this means is that if you have a desired signal to interference ratio, that tells you how many cells, how many n cells you need in your cluster.
Okay. So, again, just one last point.
The bigger n, or the higher SIR, the bigger your n needs to be.
Now, what does that mean? Well, now,
n is going to dictate how you share out your channels amongst the cluster. So the more cells you have in a cluster, the less channels each individual cell is going to get. Okay. So again, capacity is not overused, overloaded term. In this case, we were talking about essentially the number of channels, the number of active customers that NSF supports. And so, again, it's a function of how many channels are there, and they have to be divided up amongst all the cells. So, the higher your signal to interference ratio, the bigger N. The bigger N, the less channels you get per cell. Okay, so let's think about it. Hey, we've got hexagonal cells. Power is dropping off at a stand equals 2, so the square of the distance. And we decide we need some sort of minimum signal interference ratio. Again, typically these are given in decibels, but in order to use them in a problem, you have to convert out the decibels. And so you might ask, how many channels are we going to have per cell? And that means how many users can you have in that cell? So we need N to be greater than or equal to 1/3 6SIR 2 over gamma. And working that out, of gamma equals 2, that goes away. 2 SIR. Again, the sort of unfortunate thing about this example, this is SIR not in dB, but 10 dB is 10 anyway, so 10, which gives you N equals 20 altogether. Again, we can't, because of the shape of the hexagons, we can't just pick any number, we have to have ones that fit within the hexagon, so closest one is actually N is 21, so they'll remember right now what I and J, but if you work out some I and J combination to get 21, there is no I and J combination to get 20. The number of channels you have is given by your total system bandwidth, and then that required by each individual channel, so in this case you can fit in 200 channels. And so you have 21 cells per cluster shared 200 channels, and that ends up at 9 channels per cell. It's 9 point something high, but you know, if you don't have a complete channel, you have to drop down to the nearest complete number. Okay. So, again, it's a big geometric exercise, which is governed then by what your required signal to interference ratio is. Again, at the end of sort of each topic, I tend to say something about CDMA systems, so short spectrum systems. They're different, obviously, because you're using the whole spectrum in each cell. So, for CDMA systems, adjacent cells are producing interference, and more than that, you get interference within the cell. Because again, depending on how you're coding things, if the codes are not orthogonal, then users interfere with each other. That does look right here. Ah, now it's about to be 100. fix that one before I post the new slides, hopefully, if I remember. But yeah, we are corrected if it was 510, it would be 2000. Okay. So, again, that we've never asked for these formulas on an exam, but just again be aware that the interference is a combination of interference within the cell and then interference from adjacent. Now there's an additional problem within CDMA systems of power control. So again, because you have interference coming from various distances, you don't necessarily have the powers all at the same level, say something about power later, because we try and adjust the power levels to individual signals so that relative to the distance that you're receiving the power at the same level. And here we assume that we can perfectly adjust the powers that you're receiving at the same level. And in that case, again, you can get your capacity in terms of the signal interference ratio. Remove the actual power levels. That's not necessarily possible, but again, yeah, it's just rough calculations. It's usually so. Okay, so I just mean that's for sort of information purposes, just for a complete view of how these things work. Okay, so. We've, again, so far assumed that power levels are perfect, so they are uniform, essentially at the receiver. Okay. So that has to be managed. And again, this refers to the issue that within a cell, depending on how distant you are from the access point, from the base station, the perceived power levels are going to be different. And so, two directions for the communication. We have uplinks from the mobile station to the base station and downlink from the base station to the mobile unit. And in particular, what we want to do is regulate the power perceived. Power to be sufficiently great to overcome noise, and at the same time we want to transmit at a minimal level to reduce interference and to save back in power. And finally, for CDMA systems, we also need to equalize the power from all mobile units to the base station. Okay. So to do that, you'll use some sort of decision policy to decide at what power level the mobile units will transmit. And this can either be open loop, so your mobile units can just make a decision. Typically, that decision is based on what they're receiving from the base station. And the base station is emitting control signals, and they can assess the power of that control signal. And the conclusion they make is that, well, the weaker that signal, the farther away it must be from the base station, and therefore, the more power I need to get my signal back to the base station at a fixed level. This is called the channel inversion technique. So again, the weaker signal you receive, the more power you use to send your signal in order to have a fit to assume that it's going to be received at the base station at a fixed level. Okay, and then you can also have closed loop power control, so the base station can also can be involved in the decision. So the mobile units will send metrics to the base station, and then in that case, both the base station and the mobile unit can make power adjustments, so along the same order. The signal, the less power you'll transmit at. Okay. And the goal is again to try and keep the power levels at the receiver at a constant. Okay, and again, just to note, this is a significant problem at CDMA for CDMA systems. And so again, if you think about the base station receiving signals from all these users, if all the users had constant power outputs, then somebody close to the base station is going to be dominating in power, in the power that the base station receives. Again, if the codes are not fully orthogonal, that means that person close to the base station can be essentially blocking out the signal from another user who might be farther away. So again, we have a goal that we need to regulate the amount of power received at the base station. And so, using something like channel inversion techniques is how you attempt to solve this. Okay. Now, there are some problems with that. Fading channels might require higher transmission power. And again, if the fading is not uniform, then you might be fading is not uniform, you can interfere with the signals in the cell, and the higher power, the more you're going to interfere with adjacent cells as well. So, in general, this is a hard problem to solve. Okay, so we'll take our break here. Again, so far what we've seen is if we're given a signal to interference ratio, we now know how to lay out our coverage. And in particular, we know we decided that our clusters are going to be a certain size. This gives us a certain number of channels per cluster. The topic we'll take up when we come back is what's called traffic engineering. And so this says, well, you have five channels. How many users can you support in the cell? And, if they were, again, constantly on their phone, the answer would be five. But, you know, a typical phone conversation might last, who knows, a minute, 2 minutes on average. And therefore, you can actually have more users in the cell and still accommodate their needs, because you assume that they're not all going to be trying to talk at the same time. However, at some point, if you have 20 users, they may all decide to try to make a phone call at the same time. Obviously, if you have five channels, only five of them are going to be able to do that, and the other 15 are going to be disappointed. What traffic engineering does is it gives some indication of what's the likelihood of that happening. What's the likelihood of one of these 20 users trying to make a call and getting the business? We aren't going to delve deep into the mathematics of it. There's 50-year modules that cover that. We're just going to use some of these results to make a few conclusions about our systems. So we'll do that after our usual